Well, welcome to the first Parliamentary Library Lecture for 2008. I'm Roxanne Missingham, the Parliamentary Librarian, and we introduced a series called Parliamentary Library Lectures in 2006 to enable senators and members and their staff and staff in the Parliament to get an in-depth discussion of issues. We've got a separate series called Vital Issues Seminars where people give basically 20-minute presentations and we have two speakers who give different perspectives on a topic. But many topics require more than 20 minutes on a different position, and so we introduced this series that allows a whole hour to investigate a range of different issues. And today, we are very fortunate to have Professor the Honourable Alastair Nicholson to speak on citizenship, decisions by the executive as to the suitability or character of individuals, a very important topic. Professor Nicholson is well known to many in Australia and probably needs no introduction, but I'm going to just give just a few words today that really give a context for the topic and his continuing interest. Professor Nicholson has had a long and very distinguished career in law and civil liberties. He took his degree in law at the University of Melbourne in 1961, being admitted to legal practice. He joined the Victorian Bar in 1963 and in 1979 was appointed one of Her Majesty's Counsel. Between 1982 and 88, he served as a judge on the Supreme Court of Victoria, and then in 1988, I'm sure consuming his life in so many different ways, he succeeded Elizabeth Evatt as the second Chief Justice of the Family Court. He retired from this position in July 2004 after 16 years as Chief Justice of the Family Court of Australia. He has given his time unstintingly to professional and community organisations. For example, as President of the Australian Association of Family Lawyers and Conciliators in 93, President of the Association of Family and Conciliation Courts in 97, Chair of the Second World Congress on Family Law and the Rights of Children in 97, and many, many other organisations. Justice Michael Kirby has commented that in the Family Court, Nicholson presided over countless trials and appeals, dealing with every nook and cranny of family law as it's known in this country. He chaired numerous committees and meetings of the court. He attended hundreds of legal conferences in Australia and overseas. He earned recognition amongst his peers for his tremendous energy and unbounded intellectual curiosity. His mind was ever open to new concepts, including some from sources overseas. This is a feature more possible in the field of family law than most, given the universal phenomenon of family breakdown with its consequences for the upbringing of children and the division of property. He goes on to say, from the start in the family court, Nicholson had to face important challenges that would have broken a lesser spirit. On his arrival, morale was low, the court's workload grew, and its budget did not keep pace. The challenge of introducing new technology was one that he embraced with gusto. Margaret Simons in The Age observed that Nicholson has been a spectacular judge, perhaps appearing more extraordinary as the society around him has become increasingly conservative. He continues to be very active, and I encourage you to read the papers that he has written while at the University of Melbourne as professorial fellow. There are 27 on the web, and all of them give remarkable insights. He's also continued to contribute to Australian organisations and international organisations and was recently at the 2020 summit. So it's a very busy life that he continues to have. I'd like to thank you for agreeing to speak to us today, and we all welcome the opportunity to hear your lecture, which will give some other significant insights into this very important issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Roxanne, for that very fulsome introduction. I sometimes, having heard it, I almost felt I should be speaking about family law today, but I'm not. I'd like, first of all, to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land and their elders. Today, the title of what I have to say is Citizenship, Decisions by the Executive as to the Suitability or Character of Individuals. And it's really based very much, and I'll be referring in some detail as I go, to a paper about to be published by the Australia Institute, which is entitled The Dangers of Character Tests, Dr. Hanif and Other Cautionary Tales. That's a paper by Susan Harris-Rimmer, and its publication is imminent, and I regard it as a very significant contribution in this area, and it's that I should mention at the outset, because I'll be coming back to some of the issues in the paper as I proceed with my remarks today. Now, when one talks about evidence of character, the criminal law has always treated evidence of character with great caution, and it's done so for the simple reason that it is an unreliable guide as to whether a person committed an offence in question. And I think it's even more unreliable when used, as it is in migration and anti-terrorist legislation, to determine whether a person might commit an offence in the future, or in determining who should enter the country, or continue to hold a visa, or to work in certain capacities, or to be a citizen. It's not my purpose today to argue that issues of character are irrelevant to the making of those decisions, because they're clearly not. But what I'm saying is that it must be circumscribed and clearly defined as to where and how it's to be used, and the rules of natural justice must be followed in its application. So this means that the person the subject of the adverse decision must be aware of the reasons for it, the material on which it's based, and to have an opportunity to be heard before a final decision can be made. I appreciate that there are occasionally national security issues that arise in relation to this, which make the achievement of some of those objects difficult. But on the other hand, it's all too easy to hide behind the cloak of national security, in my view, for the purposes of, rendering the decision incapable of challenge. As I mentioned, the impetus for the delivery of my address today is Susan Harris-Rimmer's paper, which targets what's, I think, been a little appreciated but very real problem associated with our citizenship, migration and anti-terrorism legislation. That's namely the increasing use or misuse of assessments of character as the basis of the exercise of executive discretion. And in a sense, it goes to the heart of the defects in that legislation, in that it emphasises the almost unchecked and unchallengeable discretion, not only of ministers, but very often of bureaucrats administering the legislation. And I think that's a matter of great concern, and ought to be a matter of great concern to all Australians, that that should be the case. And it's a tendency that's extending beyond the Commonwealth. It's extending to examinations of a person's fitness to carry out all sorts of professions and activities. And it's done so in a way that really doesn't give the person affected much if or any chance of challenge. It seems to me to be the antithesis of democracy for that situation to come about. I think the concerns that I have about that also demonstrate how hollow are the protestations of the anti-Bill of Rights lobby that the common law and judicial independence are themselves sufficient protection of individual rights in our country. As you've heard, I've been a judge for many years, and I constantly felt trammelled and having the hands tied by the absence of any rights legislation in Australia, by the absence of any entitlement to civil rights on the part of citizens. And it seems to me that one of the great con acts that's been pulled by the Conservatives, and still is being pulled by the Conservatives, is that a Bill of Rights in some ways affects citizens in a detrimental way. It can only affect them, in my view, in a satisfactory way. We have, over the last 15 or so years, lived through what I would regard as a dark period of Australian history. And I think, as Susan's paper points out, it's made worse by the hysteria associated with the September 11 attacks and the Bali and London bombings, to name just a few. And those events happen to be associated with the incumbency of an extremely conservative and narrow-minded government in Australia, which nevertheless did not hesitate to wring the maximum political advantage from the situation. And in doing so, I believe that it abandoned a fine Australian tradition of the tolerance of minorities in order to, I think, deliberately isolate Islamic people. And I think the sad thing about what it did was that in doing so, it ran the risk of creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because it seems to me that the more you marginalise people in the community, the more likely it is that they will turn to extremist solutions, as we've seen in so many parts of the world, including the Middle East. And certainly, people within the Muslim community to whom I've spoken have indicated their concerns that young people in particular have felt marginalised in Australia and therefore are more amenable to the sort of persuasion that those who are evilly intended wish to proceed with. Of course, it's very easy for a government, any government, to appeal to and to marginalise other people, because I believe that in any society there is a deep streak of xenophobia and racism which responsible leaders would eschew at all costs, and which in the past Australian leaders on all sides of politics had hitherto for the most part carefully avoided. Significantly, I think Susan's paper initially concentrates on migration laws as providing the bellwether for the other objectionable legislation that followed, and particularly the character tests applied in relation to immigration. I think this is significant because historically migration laws have reflected the fears and prejudices of the Australian community against those who come from beyond our shores. And of course, there's a paradox about that, because apart from Indigenous people, we're all in that category. But I suppose it's the old story of once on board, you can push the others off. There were throughout the 19th century, of course, many examples of legal and actual discrimination against people from places other than Britain, and particularly much evidence of discrimination against the Chinese who arrived in Australia in some numbers. And following Federation, that culminated in the Immigration Restrictions Act of 1901, which was one of the first pieces of legislation passed by the new federal parliament. And its flavour, I think, can be determined from the following extract. The immigration into the Commonwealth of the persons described in any of the following paragraphs of this section, hereafter called prohibited immigrants, is prohibited. Namely, and this is the beauty which we're all familiar with, any person who, when asked to do so by an officer, fails to write out at dictation and sign in the presence of the officer a passage of 50 words in length in a European language directed by the officer. That actually formed the basis of the White Australia policy, that particular provision. And it went on to also include any person likely, in the opinion of the minister or of any officer, become a charge upon the public, any idiot or insane person, people suffering from infectious or contagious diseases, people who have been convicted for 3 years, who have within 3 years been convicted of an offence, not being a mere political offence, which is interesting. I'm not sure what a mere political offence was or what they meant by that, but perhaps it was a good one to put in. And of course, it had been sentenced to imprisonment for 1 year or longer. And finally, any prostitute or person living on the prostitution of others. So that act determined who might migrate to and settle in Australia, as well as who might be counted as an Australian national, and thus gain access to the rights and entitlements afforded to Australian citizens. Of course, its most notorious provision was the dictation test. It was based, appropriately enough, I suppose, on the Natal, South Africa Immigration Restriction Act of 1897. And rather than immigrants appearing to be prevented from entering on the grounds of race, the test used literacy to discriminate against non-Europeans. And legislation involving a similar test had already been introduced by Federation in Western Australia, New South Wales and Tasmania. Of course, this test was not just used to exclude coloured people. It was also used to exclude people whose political views didn't suit the incumbent government. And there's something rather familiar about that. But a famous example coming from those earlier times was the case of Egon Kish, where the Commonwealth refused entry to the Czech writer Kish, who was an avowed anti-Nazi, for his alleged communist sympathies. At that stage, presumably, we encouraged the Nazis more than we did the communists. Kish was purported to be excluded by immigration authorities for failing a dictation test in Gaelic. And the High Court later held that was not a recognised European language. And it struck me that decision in itself must have caused offence amongst those Australians of Celtic descent. But anyway, the bureaucratic oversight was quickly corrected and Kish was eventually deported. But although the dictation test is gone, it would appear that nothing else has changed, or nothing much else. The case that has remarkable similarities to Kish is the recent case of Scott Parkin, which is discussed in detail in Susan Rimmer's paper. Mr. Parkin, you might recall, was an American who was thought to be some kind of a danger to the country after he got here, was arrested and deported, his visa was withdrawn. He didn't fail a dictation test, but he failed a much more difficult test, I would have thought, namely an ASIO assessment, which remains secret and therefore can't be challenged or refuted. It ought to concern all of us that not only is this the case, but that pursuant to the legislation, the minister can't go behind the ASIO test or to exercise a discretion in favour of the person concerned, which really gives the decision-making power to a secret and unaccountable body. Occasionally, as a judge, I used to hear that judges were unelected and unaccountable, but I don't think we were quite as unaccountable, perhaps, as ASIO is. But one would have been forgiven for thinking that cases such as that of Kish were well behind us until the early 1990s, when the Hawke and later the Hawke-Keating government started what seemed to be an inexorable process of making the Migration Act more restrictive, while at the same time extending provisions for the detention of so-called illegal immigrants. And under that government and the succeeding Howard government, detainees were largely held at remote and inaccessible places such as Port Hedland, Woomera, Baxter, and later at even more inaccessible places to which Australian law did not run, such as PNG, Nauru, and Christmas Island, which was later conveniently excised from the Commonwealth for the purpose. The purpose, I believe, was clear, which was to isolate these people from lawyers, firstly, but also from other sources of support in the community, and above all, to isolate them from the Australian community. So it was possible to sell them as non-persons. It was possible to sell them as people, not as people at all. They were illegals, queue jumpers, people that one could use vituperative language about. I found it then, and I still find it very difficult to understand the justification for this process, which carried with it much that was antithetical to what most of us would have believed were the Australian values that were more recently enshrined in the citizenship test of the Howard government. Of course, the majority of people so detained were eventually released into the community, and there's no reason to believe that those who were not irreparably harmed by the process have become other than good citizens. The process of detention accelerated under the Howard government to a point where children were being incarcerated in detention centres for years, and where the High Court of Australia, I believe to its discredit, eventually held that it was open to the executive to detain an illegal immigrant indefinitely without trial, in the case of Al-Khateb and Goodwin. In the Family Court, we made a brief essay into this jurisdiction by directing the minister to release certain children, but the High Court said we didn't have the power to do that either. It may, however, have started something in that there was a change in policy about children shortly thereafter, and by and large, children ceased to be detained in these appalling conditions. But thinking about the High Court, one could but wish that it could have brought itself to adopt what I believe to have been the principled approach of the United States Supreme Court in the case of Bermudian and Bush, which was delivered on the 12th of June of this year, where the majority judgment quoted Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers of the United States, to the effect that the practice of arbitrary imprisonment had been in all ages the favourite and most formidable instrument of tyranny. It was a view that they said went back to Blackstone, and they also quoted Blackstone's view, I quote, that confinement of the person by secretly hurrying him to jail, where his sufferings are unknown or forgotten, is a less public, a less striking, and therefore a more dangerous engine of arbitrary government. And it seems to me that's precisely what we were doing. The American judgment expressed particular concern as to the position of persons held in detention without trial, saying, I quote, where a person is detained by executive order, rather than, say, after being tried and convicted in a court, the need for collateral review is most pressing. A criminal conviction in the usual course occurs after a judicial hearing before a tribunal disinterested in the outcome and committed to procedures designed to ensure its own independence. These dynamics are not inherent in executive detention orders or executive review procedures. And in this context, the need for habeas corpus is more urgent. Now, of course, it was a close-run thing in the United States Supreme Court, as we know. It was 5-4 in favour of the majority. And in the High Court here, it was 4-3 the other way in Alcatemp's case. So you can see how finely balanced some of these difficult issues are. And I think it may have more than a little bit to do with the fact that they developed a practice, both in the United States and here, of appointing extremely conservative people to both the Supreme Court and the High Court of Australia in the hope of producing results that were favourable to a conservative cause. But it's ironic that it's been left to an American court to recognise the real dangers inherent in the practices that we accepted so readily in this country. Of course, the plight of persons outside Australia was even worse. For example, Mohammed Sagar and Mohammed Faisal were found to have achieved refugee status, but you'll remember were detained on Nauru after everyone else had gone on the basis of unfavourable and again unchallengeable ASIO assessments, calling their character into question, which left them in a stateless no man's land. One has now been admitted to Australia after suffering severe psychiatric illness, and the other to a Scandinavian country, but not before they suffered detention for many years. Ms. River in her paper graphically demonstrates what I believe to be the cruelty perpetuated by the Howard government, and by Minister Ruddock in particular, in using character assessments to institute a purge of permanent residents who'd broken the law, which had occurred in over 300 cases involving long-term residents since the 1999 amendments of the Howard government made this possible. Again, the High Court found itself unable or unwilling to interfere with the process in Nystrom's case, where a 33-year-old was deported to Sweden after living in Australia for the whole of his life, apart from his first 27 days. True it is that he had committed a number of serious crimes, as had many of the other people. But it seems to me that when people have been in Australia for that long and they commit crimes, I think that we should regard them as our criminals rather than someone else's criminals. And we certainly shouldn't be engaging in the cruelty of sending them to foreign countries where they don't speak the language and where they have no ties. I think that there was an appalling cynicism about this approach by the former government, and it was fanned, I believe, by sections of the media who like to fan the law and order argument. And of course, there's little or no public sympathy for people who've committed crimes, whatever their mental state. It therefore is all too easy for governments to dispose of these persons and even score political points by doing so. And similarly, there's a little political value in the possibility of detriment for an opposition to oppose such a misuse of power. An examination of Section 501 of the Migration Act is both instructive and disturbing. It provides that natural justice rules don't apply to a minister's decision to refuse or cancel a visa if the minister reasonably suspects that a person may not pass the character test, and the minister is satisfied that the refusal or cancellation is in the national interest, whatever that means. There's then a lengthy statement of the circumstances in which the minister may determine that a person has not passed the character test that includes the possession of a substantial criminal record. And importantly, and I think this is very important, it provides for exclusion or non-passing of the test if the person has or has had an association with someone else or with a group or organisation whom the minister reasonably suspects has been or is involved in criminal conduct. That, of course, was the nub of the Hanif case, which Susan Harris-Rimmer has discussed in considerable detail and which I don't propose to discuss in that detail today. But the nub of it was that the minister regarded it as enough, based on an earlier decision, for the association to be no more than an association of knowing someone, effectively having a relationship with someone. So really you were guilty because your brother was, or your cousin was, and so on. But it was really only, as she points out, chance that Hanif succeeded in the federal court, because the minister relied upon the earlier interpretation, which was found to be wrong, and therefore the judgment was set aside. But had he adopted a different interpretation, and one that the federal court eventually adopted, then the decision would not have been set aside, and presumably Mr. Hanif would still be where he was. But this sort of a test is a classic example of guilt by association. And it seems to me that we've come a long way down a very dangerous path where we destroy people's livelihoods and futures on the decision of ministers acting upon secret and unchallengeable information that may well be quite inaccurate, as that case graphically demonstrated. And I won't go into those details, but you'll recall that there were many areas where the information conveyed was absolutely wrong. Saraswamy also makes the point with which I agree, that the criteria in section 501 represents Australian values in only a particularly narrow and subjective way. And she quotes Dr. Mary Crock, saying that the strict application of the character test in section 501 would write off Nelson Mandela and Mahatma Gandhi, to name but a few. And I could name a few more. I was thinking about Shanana Gusmao was no doubt to have a problem too in coming to Australia, and there'd be many others. It's even more troublesome to consider what would have happened if the Hanif case had his interrogation been conducted by ASIO. The author sets out in her paper the powers of ASIO in relation to the interrogation of terrorism suspects. And it's chilling, I believe, to reflect that had ASIO rather than the AFP undertaken that interrogation, then Hanif would not only likely to be still in custody, but we would never have heard of him. It would have been a criminal offence for Hanif himself, the media, myself, anyone else to have discussed the matter, which means that could have gone on behind our backs without any knowledge on the part of the Australian community. It's apparent that the inability to obtain successful review of decisions by the minister is reinforced by his ability to rely upon information supplied to him in confidence by AFP and other security agencies. And the minister can not only refuse to convey the information to the person affected, but can refuse to convey it to the court, which really makes a mockery of any court process that takes place if the minister was to take that view. Well, today I've been discussing issues in relation to immigration rather than citizenship. But I think it's worth, at this stage, taking a few minutes to examine the past history of citizenship in Australia. It's a term that's used very broadly, but it was and is a somewhat amorphous concept that's difficult to define with precision in the Australian context. It's interesting to remember that before 1948, Australians, other than Indigenous Australians, were simply British subjects. At Federation in 1901, British subject was the sole civic status noted in the Australian Constitution. The Australian Federal Convention was unable to agree on a definition of the term citizen and wanted to preserve British nationality in Australia. There was a bit of a feeling, as I gather too, that it was 100 and something years since the French Revolution, talking about citizens was a bit dangerous. It might give the public ideas. So the idea of subject was preferred to that of citizen. But it's important to remember that there was no other status in our constitution. And we really adopted an administrative approach to determining who was a citizen and not, in order to distinguish between people, some British subjects and others, for the purposes of deportation. It wasn't until 1948 that the Nationality and Citizenship Act was passed. And that in itself was a creation of Arthur Cole, who was a great nationalist, but had some fairly limited approaches to matters. You could be a citizen if you were born to an Australian father, but mother was no good. Only fathers qualified. You had 5 years' residence. You had to have 5 years' residence for those from Britain and Ireland, to be of good character, have a knowledge of English, and to have an adequate knowledge of the rights and responsibilities and privileges of Australian citizenship and intend to reside in Australia. And you could be naturalised if an alien, which required all of the above, on swearing an oath of allegiance to the monarch of Great Britain. An alien was someone who didn't have the status of a British subject and was not an Irish citizen or a protected person, which was often the official status of Aboriginal people. In 1958, the Act was amended, and this was an important amendment, so that naturalisation could only be revoked if obtained by fraud. This prevented a naturalised person being stripped of citizenship and deported. But again, it's only a piece of legislation that protects that right. And going back to my Bill of Rights argument, and we've heard recently in some of the shriller attacks on certain Islamic people in the community that they should be stripped of their citizenship. And again, we're going down a very doubtful path, I believe, if we go that way. Of course, continuing with history, in 1973, the Act was renamed the Australian Citizenship Act, and so we did become Australian citizens. And then, however, it was not until 1984 that we ceased to be British subjects, which would be within the lifetime of most of those present in the room anyway. In 1965, the White Australia policy was abandoned by the Labor Party, and the Liberal government did the same thing in the following year. And then, of course, we had a constitutional referendum which altered the constitution to allow Aboriginal people to be counted in the census, and the Commonwealth to enact special laws for them. Kim Rubenstein, in a paper in the Melbourne University Law Review, commented in 2000 that at that time the present formulation of a citizen was reasonably clear. You could become one by birth if at the time of your birth at least one parent was an Australian citizen or an Australian permanent resident, so the mothers had got in by this stage. You could become one by adoption if adopted by an Australian citizen, by descent if a parent's an Australian citizen and registers the child's name at an Australian consulate within 18 years of birth, or by a grant of citizenship. But she pointed to two issues of exclusion that were there. Previously, if you were born in Australia, that was sufficient. The legislation had changed by then to make it clear that being born in Australia wasn't good enough. And this was, of course, directed at many of the people who we detained and held in detention over such a period. And then there was also a provision about the grant of Australian citizenship and ministerial discretion, and that contained the similar provisions to those that had occurred earlier. But by and large, my comment about citizenship prior to 2007 was that governments were not going out of their way to find that people were unsuitable to become Australian citizens. In fact, rather the contrary. There was lots of advertising would take place urging people to go and become Australian citizens. It was seen to be something that was preferable, and in fact the government was saying that more people and more people in the community should do it, rather than imposing barriers against it. And I think that was a much more sensible and reasonable approach to the problem. But of course in 2007 Parliament passed the Citizenship Act, and that introduced more stringent character checks in home countries when applying for citizenship. It introduced ASIO checks. The time for the permanent residence extended from 12 months to 4 years. And applicants were now required to pass the compulsory multiple choice citizenship test. I find it very surprising that 106 years after Federation, it suddenly was thought necessary to impose an examination test in a country with a rich assimilation of history of assimilating people from all over the world, and to do so by asking what I believe to be largely inane questions about supposed Australian values, which many of the native-born population would probably be unable to answer anyway. The Act, of course, was introduced in the context of anti-terrorism legislation, and the motivation for it was obviously associated with that. And I think there was an element of dog whistle politics about it. And I think, unfortunately, the present government in opposition took the tactical approach of not opposing it, and are therefore stuck with it. And I know that there's a committee which is considering introducing a different and less stringent test, but really it's something that we should have got rid of. And it's a great pity that I think that the ALP had supported that legislation to the point where they couldn't turn around when they came to office and get rid of it. It had a pretty weak sort of justification. I was looking at the Department of Immigration and Citizenship's explanation of why the test had been introduced. It was to help migrants integrate and maximise the opportunities available to them in Australia. How could you help people by imposing an examination on them? and it provides a strong incentive for new arrivals to learn English and to understand the Australian way of life. Again, this, I think, really misunderstands what happens with new arrivals to this country. In one of my sort of part-time interests, I'm patron of an organisation in Box Hill in Victoria, which actually teaches English to migrants. And I've been along and I've sat in on some of these classes, and many of the people there have been in Australia for many years, but many of them are people who they really didn't have time because they had kids, many in the cases of women, they had a lot of work to do in the case of the men, were unable to actually learn English with the English classes that were provided, so that's why we're providing these classes now. But these people are ideal people, they'd be very good citizens. And yet, of course, they're struggling at this stage to try and get some grasp of English sufficient to pass this sort of test. I just don't understand why we stand in the path of people like this. It just doesn't make sense. So, another area which I'll really touch on is the use of character tests to determine the eligibility for particular employment in the aviation industry or other areas that are seen to be areas where terrorists may operate. Maybe one thing to have a reasonable security system in relation to those industries. But I think it's quite another, again, to start depriving people of their livelihood on the basis of assessments that they can't challenge. And that's the sort of thing that's happening all too often. And then, finally, there's the issue of terrorism. And I've already touched on some of the objectionable aspects of the counter-terrorism legislation. In an earlier speech on this subject, I said that there were certain fundamental rights and freedoms that we enjoyed prior to 9/11. These included the presumption of innocence, proof beyond reasonable doubt as a prerequisite of a criminal conviction, freedom of speech and movement, and the inability of the state to detain us except when convicted of an offence in court, with the power to punish by way of imprisonment the sole province of the courts, following a fair and public trial, coupled with extensive rights of appeal. In particular, we were entitled to refuse to answer questions by police seeking our identity or information as to who we were, what we were, or what we'd been doing. If a police officer wished to detain us, he or she had to have sufficient evidence to lay criminal charges against us, which had to be laid forthwith with an entitlement to be brought before a court. I think we all thought that those rights and freedoms were ours and that they were immutable. I think we placed what now appears to have been a simplistic trust in our institutions, and particularly our governments, to observe these rights and protect our freedoms. And in the circumstances, it seems to me that there is now almost an unanswerable case that those rights and freedoms can only be protected by a Bill of Rights and by eventually a constitutional amendment that confirms them. I'd like to perhaps just finish by referring to policy suggestions that Ms. Harris-Rimmer has made, with which I strongly agree. And she says first that the first priority is that Section 501 of the Migration Act and similar provisions in Commonwealth law should be repealed or amended to provide for clarity, transparency and natural justice. She said the second priority is that data on refusals on character grounds across migration, citizenship and employment law be collected and tabled in Parliament. Thirdly, she says that the case studies and case law discussed in the paper show a prima facie need for a parliamentary inquiry to be held in the current Parliament into the interaction of character tests across migration, citizenship, employment and criminal law. Fourthly, she says there's a need, if there is a positive decision in the Parkin case, to infer that adverse ASIO assessments are made reviewable in substance, not just form, with a minimum requirement being that the affected person gets some indication of the basis of the assessment. Finally, she says that ministers in the right government could make an undertaking that ministerial discretion around issues of character will be used as the last resort safeguard it was intended to be, instead of constituting the system itself. She says the development of character tests whose purpose is to align people as like us or not like us should be rejected. I strongly agree with her. I commend her on a fine and objective piece of scholarship, and I'm proud to be associated with it and to support it. And I thank you for your attention as well. Now, questions? Yes.
Have you had the opportunity opportunity yet to evaluate the current government's policies in this area, particularly in relation to those issues that could sit under the sort of secret police heading?
Not really, no. No, I haven't. I mean, I'm still waiting to see. I think there are some hopeful signs, but I'm not suggesting that there are not, but I think it's probably too early to see just where it stands. It's a very difficult area, I know, the government, and I know they've had a fair bit on their hands today.
Do you think that this is a really good opportunity to discuss the Bill of Rights? It's interesting for us in the ACT with John Stanhope,
yes.
Who's been an extremely strong advocate, but it doesn't seem to have had a lot of traction yet.
No, well, that's true. Victoria, of course, has introduced a charter as well, which I think is a bit weak, but it's a step in the right direction. And when you look at it, except when one reads The Australian, there doesn't seem to be a great degree of public concern about it in Victoria as yet. I think it's getting some traction there. I think it's probably the right way to go in some ways, to have the states do this. Mm. And then I think it's a little easier for the federal government to pick it up as well. But I hope so anyway. Mm. I know, of course, the Attorney General has shown some interest in this area, and I think I'm right in saying he's proposing some kind of an examination of the issue. I'm not sure. I don't know that he said precisely what it is, but he's certainly looking at it.
Don, mm. Could you have another?
Oh, I was just thinking, Judge. I think the current Minister Chris Evans says he doesn't like his godlike powers.
I saw that. Yes, yes. Yes. Which was a good sign, I thought, too. Yes. And I sympathise with him, actually.
Indeed.
Yes. I think perhaps one of the other issues, and I'm not knocking the bureaucrats in it either, but there's so many matters come up that it must be very difficult for a minister to keep on top of it, and for the bureaucrats who are dealing with it to actually know which way to go as well, given the sort of breadth of the discretion. Yes.
Does it concern you that the government's tendency to take a populist approach to many issues, the current government's tendency, might have an adverse effect on its inclination to do something about this?
Well, I think I'm concerned about any government taking populist approaches on issues, because I think it always affects their inclination to act properly. I wouldn't as yet accuse this government of acting in the same sort of populist way as some of its predecessors. I hope it doesn't. I mean, there are certain issues, obviously, that one could say it might have done that, but I don't as yet detect a real danger of that. I hope I'm right, anyway. Yes?
I was just wondering, when you were talking about or referring to the security assessments that a lot of these character studies rely upon, are you sort of suggesting that security assessments shouldn't be a routine part of that, or that they should be more transparent?
I think we should look at the number of cases where we really need them. So I'd like to see less security assessments. I'd like to see it a much more a more last resort type approach. But certainly, I think they should be transparent. And transparent as far as it can be. I mean, there may be circumstances, and I think we'll all agree there could be circumstances where it's difficult to simply hand over the whole document. But there are ways around that. I mean, for example, there have been plenty of cases of litigation where issues of privilege or that sort of thing have arisen, and the judge perhaps will strictly limit the sort of information, including in some cases not permitting the accused person to have access them directly to it. So I think there are ways to approach that. And again, it's a last resort mechanism. It's not the sort of first line of defence, which seems to be the current situation. Yes?
Mine's not about character, but you mentioned before about the people not being able to speak English after,
yes,
you know, so many years here.
Mm.
Do you think that there should be some requirement for you know, some English language. I'm thinking of those who are not really able to read the affirmation to repeat the oath when they're naturalised, for instance.
I don't. Well, we administer oaths through interpreters every day in the courts.
Yes, I guess so.
I don't see that as a problem. I don't really see this requirement of speaking English. I mean, it's desirable. I think it's highly. It's preferable that people should be encouraged to speak English, but I don't know that the speaking of English is necessarily a determination as to whether the person's a good citizen or is likely to be or not. It seems to me that if one went back to some of one's own ancestors, I'm not so sure how good their English would have been when they were here. And some of them, no doubt, the older ones, it's often more difficult for an older person to pick up a foreign language, and I think we forget that too.
You don't see it as an isolating factor?
Oh, it clearly is an isolating factor, and that's why I encourage people to learn English if they can, but it shouldn't be a disqualifying factor. I think it's a question of encouragement and education rather than saying, and you can't join us unless you do, which is what we're saying now.
Well, yes, that's true.
I think that would be a fundamental change to Australian citizenship legislation, because it has been a requirement since 1949 that someone has English. And I also understand that if you're over 60, you can be excluded.
You can.
Or you are excluded from that requirement.
Yes, you are. I should have mentioned that. But on the other hand, there's plenty of people in their late 40s and 50s that might struggle a bit at learning another language too. So, okay. And that's really what I'm talking about.
And I have taught ESL, and I've found that there are people who are not literate in their own language.
That's right.
Which makes learning, one I'm thinking of in particular was a woman in her 40s, and I had to teach her the whole literacy concept.
Yes. Yes, well, that's a very good point. And again, why disqualify people, be perfectly decent people, just because of those sort of considerations? But I agree, it would be a radical change. But really, I think that goes back to the point I'm making, that we have had. I think it's time we did radically rethink what we were doing in these areas, that we've come from what was essentially a very racist and very limited background in terms of migration, which I think the history shows. I thought we were gradually improving, and then we seem to have jumped back in 2007.
I think the issue is that I would tend to think that someone should have a basic level of English to help them participate in society.
No, I think
the conception is that the test has made that issue of basic English somewhat.
Raise the level.
It's a question of what's basic English, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, I can visit France and sort of struggle around a bit.
And
you're
lucky.
And that's about it.
I can't.
But I suppose someone might say I speak basic French, but I don't think I do. But I can take part in life there.
Yes.
Perhaps the word girt by sea is beyond.
Well, we never say the second verse of the, which is much more inclusive.
As a blue-collar worker in Melbourne, I worked with a lot of other migrants who were exceedingly good, hard-working citizens who had exceedingly limited English.
Yep.
And the one thing they would always say is that their children were getting the proper education. And I think it's exceedingly short-sighted to put restrictions on people simply because of their language skills. These were productive, honest, hard-working people.
I agree.
And their families were going to go on and continue to contribute to society.
I mean, I agree entirely with what you say, and indeed I've seen it many times in the courts. I mentioned we often give an oath through an interpreter, and I've seen some very fine people who've lived in Australia for many years who really can't speak English, but are still very good citizens, the same way that you refer to.
I draw this absolutely excellent session to a close. Before I thank our speaker today, I'd just like to remind everyone that for all of our Bible Issues seminars and our Parliamentary Library lectures, slides, papers and presentations and oral files are available on the Library's intranet, and I'd encourage you to have a look. And we will put in the next issue of this sitting week the link to the presentation today. But on behalf of everyone here and the people who will read and listen to your speech, in future days after this. Thank you so much for giving us a terrific presentation on this incredibly important issue.
Thanks, Thank you.
And our next lecture will be on oil. So very versatile. I'm just reading the manuscript of the